From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Bassist Reggie Scanlon is a master of good timing.
A lot of my career was just being in the right place at the right time and basically lucking out.
Nearly half a century on the bandstand with Professor Longhair, the Radiators, and now with the New Orleans Suspects, taught Scanlon how to play and how to survive the music business, one bar fight at a time.
If it was like some couple just having like a husband and wife fight with a pool cue and a bottle, you just, you know, you keep your eye on it, but you knew it was just going to be between them.
So hunker down and join us for one of our favorite interviews from 2012. Reggie Scanlon, after the break. Last summer, after 33 years together in music, the Radiators disbanded. 33 years is longer than most people stay married, and yet the band ended exactly as it began, with the same singer-songwriters, same keyboardist, same guitarist, same drummer, and Reggie Scanlon on bass. If you've never had the pleasure of hearing the Radiators perform, despite their 14 albums, countless bootlegs, and more than 3,000 performances nationwide, the only logical question to ask is,
where was you at?
Where was you at?
Where was you at?
Where was you at?
Keep a good bass player down. Reggie Scanlon is now in another band of giants called the New Orleans Suspects, which has already produced its first self-titled CD. To paraphrase one of their songs, every wind in Reggie Scanlon's life finds its way down to the sea of great New Orleans music.
Every wind in a river finds its own way down to the sea.
Bassist Reggie Scanlon, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I love that song. I love both of those songs. But man, that Every Wind in the River, it's philosophy, but it's also funky fun.
Well, you know, it's got one of those kind of feelings to it where you, I mean, for me, I could just listen to that all day long almost. It's just got a nice groove to it. It's not too fast, not too slow. Just feels good.
It's true. It's true. Now, you talk like somebody from around here.
Oh, yeah.
Where are you
born,
from?
Born and raised here.
In New Orleans?
In New Orleans.
Not Metairie, not St. Bernard.
Born at Touro Hospital. I was born and raised uptown, and I'm still living uptown.
And so tell us about where you come from. I mean...
I grew up, like I said, uptown, first on... on Valmont and Marengo Street. Then we moved out to Burdett Street up by St. Rita's. You know, I've got three younger sisters. My folks got divorced when I was pretty young. And basically, I grew up in a household full of women. You know, my grandmother, my mother. You know, my grandmother's this old, you know, Italian hardcore, you know, didn't take anything from anybody. So it's a Catholic city, so everybody went to Catholic school. I did go to a lot of high schools, though, I have to say. We always had like these kind of philosophical disagreements about haircuts and uniforms and stuff like that. So I was always invited not to come back.
So your hair was long and your terms were short at the schools, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
I see.
Exactly.
And so here you are, you're the oldest child, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a boy.
Yeah.
And you've got these three sisters. They say when you put three sisters together, there's always drama. So what did your household sound like?
Oh, it was like, it was me playing a lot of records all the time. And then my sisters, you know, were running around making as much noise as they could. And... The first records I remember hearing were things like somebody had a George Lewis record. that I really, really like.
The clarinet player.
Yeah, yeah. That and, you know, Pete Font records, Al Hurt type of things, you know, Louis Armstrong's Hello Dolly, is that, you know, is that kind of stuff. You know, then the Beatles came along, and so, you know, everybody was buying that kind of stuff. But I listened to this John Mayall album, the first John Mayall and Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton on it, and that was really my entree, I guess, into real blues music. I started looking at the names of the songs, you know, and so I started looking for the guys who wrote the songs. That kind of led to Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, and once I found those guys, it was, you know, the English stuff was over with. So I was listening to a whole lot of that stuff, and then that got me into kind of like the Stax thing. And by that time, I was kind of fooling around on the bass. And, you know, Duck Dunn was somebody that was a first big influence because...
Duck Dunn from the Memphis sound, yeah.
He's one of these kind of bass players who... It sounded like what he was doing was real simple. So it was like, okay, I can do that. But then, of course, you start studying it, and it's like... This guy's so far beyond, you know, it just seems simple. And so I was into him and Jerry Jamont, who was a session bass player, who was probably became like my guy. I mean, he was subsequently got to meet him and hang out a little bit with him. And he is really just an amazing, amazing man.
So, you know, with everyone who comes on the show, we like to ask a question about if you can think of a song growing up that you listened to over and over and over again, you know, that might have helped you ultimately become who you are. I mean, a song that made you want to, I guess, pick up a bass or be on a bandstand.
Oh, yeah, it was a whole album.
Yeah.
It was Freddie King's My Feeling for the Blues. It was him, and then the band on it was Jerry Jamont with, you know, it was the King Curtis Band.
Right.
Every song on that album just had this amazing bass feel to it. And I spent years just learning that album, you know, and it was just an inspiration. I mean, anytime I'd feel like I needed to go back to something, I'd go back to that record.
Is there a sweet spot on that CD or on that album where it all comes together?
Woke up this morning, that and The Stumble. I mean, Jerry Jamont, just everything you need to know about a bass, it's pretty much right in that stuff.
Woke up this morning, my bed was gone. Woke up this morning, my bed was gone. I feel so bad, I was all alone. Ain't got nobody stay home with me. I ain't got nobody stay home with me. My baby, she's gone. I'm in misery. Well, baby, don't you want a man like me? Well, baby, don't you want a man like me? I can love you, baby, better than you used to be. Well, baby, I'm all alone.
what is everything you need to know about a bass? I mean, obviously it's going to take a lot longer than we have, but I mean, but what is it that a bass player is looking for?
You're looking for a groove that basically unites the rhythm, which, you know, the drums, with the melodic stuff that's going on. It's kind of like the bridge between those things. But you also want it to have some sort of a movement to it that kind of catches people up in that.
Back to Jamont, though. He just had the feeling.
When you listen to him on like the old Aretha things, like Chain of Fools, or The Thrill Is Gone. He played bass on The Thrill Is Gone.
Oh.
I mean, he was a master of, you know, doing a lot of stuff with not a whole lot of notes.
Buying your first bass?
The first bass I actually wanted to buy was, there used to be a bunch of pawn shops downtown right off on Rampart Street, and there was one called Eagle Loan.
Okay.
Everybody used to go there to get their instruments. So I go down there, and they got a Fender bass, you know, and the guy said, well, you know, it's $95. I said, it's only got 3 strings on it. I said, you know, it doesn't have a case. He said, okay, well, $85. So bought it. And it's still the best sounding bass that I own.
No way, really?
Oh yeah. It's the bass that went through like everything with me. That bass is still like, I mean, I bring it in the studio, they don't even have to EQ it. It's just like,
really?
Yeah, it's like butter. That bass is just like butter.
Have you ever been moved to sing?
Oh yeah, but I'm usually trying to keep people in the club. I don't even sing in the shower anymore because I can't stand it. I can't.
Come on. Really?
Believe me, it's my voice is something you don't want to really be subjected to.
It's not a human rights violation or anything, is it?
It actually could be, you know, depending on how long I was singing. It might be.
Given the fact that you have performed with some of the best, you know, in New Orleans, and that your earliest memories of music are New Orleans musicians, I mean, how do you explain the New Orleans sound? What does it mean to you that term, New Orleans sound?
It's mostly the rhythm. I mean, people don't play straight on the beat like they do other places here. You know, it's either like jumped ahead or you play back on it or something like that, you know, mm-hmm. where it gives it that kind of push-pull thing or that kind of second, what people call second line.
And so you have your bass here, actually, in the studio with us.
Well, yeah, it's actually studio bass.
It's the studio bass?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, you can light up just about anything.
I guess. I don't know.
But would you mind showing us a little bit of what you're talking about in terms of rhythm, in terms of the difference between the New Orleans rhythm and a straight-ahead one?
Well, like a thing like a New Orleans thing would be like... You know, if you were in Chicago, it'd be more like. You know, it's more of a straight ahead thing.
I mean, that's a big difference.
Yeah, so I mean, you got that kind of little jumpy thing going on.
Do that. Would you mind doing that again? Chicago versus.
Uh... And, you know, if you're in Chicago, it'd be like, you know, it's just, New Orleans has those kind of syncopated drum rhythms. It's, you hear it in the brass bands. Even you go to a funeral, you know, they're going to play the dirge. But after that's over, it's happy music.
Reggie Scanlon and the Radiators on a 2007 unreleased recording of Didn't He Ramble? In case you're wondering, the answer is yes. More from Reggie Scanlon after the break. Stay with us.
A lot of my career was just being in the right place at the right time and basically lucking out.
That's Reggie Scanlon. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is a rebroadcast of a 2012 episode of Music Inside Out. Watches don't have the timing Reggie Scanlon does. Before his 33-year gig with the Radiators, Scanlon lucked onto bandstands with two of the best piano players New Orleans has ever produced. First, he was with James Booker. And in early 1976, when Scanlon was playing the Chitlin' Circuit in California, Professor Longhair called.
So I went back and played with him for a year. I have to say, he was an absolute prince. He was one of the nicest gentlemen you could ever work with or be around. He was great to his friends. I mean, he had people staying at his house, you know, friends that couldn't afford to stay other places. And, you know, I mean, he was a very generous and great human being. He's what everybody should aspire to. And his plan, I could never figure out what he needed a bass player for. His left hand was so heavy that it was all I could do just to, like, keep up with him.
Well, yeah, because the piano is part of the rhythm section.
Oh, yeah, and especially his style was, that's what it was all about. And plus, his stuff was so precise. There wasn't a lot of room to, like, fudge on where the note was going to fall. You had to be right on it with him. He was also great because he wasn't one of these kind of guys that if you made a mistake, you know, all of a sudden it was on the news at 5 o'clock, you know. You know.
He wouldn't punch you on the bandstand. He wouldn't.
No, he just gave you this little look like, you know, and I was like, don't do that anymore. Okay. But he gave you the latitude to try stuff because he told me one time, he said, I forget what it was. And he was like, I like that. He said, I like strange sounds. People might say I'm exaggerating, but I can tell you, even now, you feel his loss. You know, it's almost like there's never been anybody who has come along to fill the space that he filled.
Hush your mouth, Roy, you're talking real silly. Open up your eyes and see. That ain't nothing but the next door neighbor's little baby. She and him and me. I said I've been all over the world. I knew the Gulf of Mexico. And I've
and I ain't never saw no baby 5'6" before. And the next night when I came home, the next night when I came home, the next night when I came home, yeah, I am all alone.
When your original band with Professor Longhair broke up, or at least was relieved of duty.
Yes.
You said that, you know, you had already begun your life with the Radiators.
That afternoon.
That very afternoon.
Yeah.
That is excellent timing.
It really was like a seamless transition to something that, I mean, I had, you know, there was no way of knowing that it was going to last as long as it did. I mean, we thought we'd be lucky if we stayed together 6 months and could pay our rent, you know? That'd be like, wow. I was in a successful band. We paid our rent for 6 months, you know?
Well, it's true, but at the same time, I mean, given what you've told us about how you came up, you know, in your household of women, you know, then going to these very interesting, very creative, but very unpredictable acts to some degree.
Yeah.
By the time you get to the Radiators, you've had a lot of training in remaining cool and calm no matter what.
That the Chitlin' Circuit did that. It was like, you know, when you have people running in with shotguns and stuff, you kind of adjust your kind of reality every now and then, you know.
It's true. That Chitlin' Circuit in California, right?
Yeah.
You remained steady throughout.
Well, through all of this stuff, I just wanted to play blues music. You know, that was my whole thing. I just wanted to play bass, you know. But in order to do that, you'd have to find yourself in these bizarro situations sometimes. And the drummer who I worked with was an older guy who kind of showed me the ropes, you know, like a guy comes in with a gun. I mean, just drop your bass and dive, you know, just,
that's
you
a good
know,
role.
And he, yeah. You know, people pull out knives, you know, you just keep, you know, it's just basic survival 101 type stuff.
When do you keep playing just in hopes that the situation will die down? And when do you, other than a gun, when do you know it's time to get off the bandstand?
Usually we would know when it was time to get off the bandstand when there'd be a complete rush on the dance floor of people going toward the back of the bandstand where the back door was. That was always a good signal that it was time to bail. If it was like some couple just having like a husband and wife fight with a pool cue and a bottle, you keep your eye on it, but you knew it was just going to be between them. And also, you know that the owner of the club, who was usually 9 out of 10 times a woman, would just wade in and knock both of them out. And that would be the end of that, you know?
Let the system work. That's
yeah,
what
because,
you're saying.
Because they didn't like any of that stuff going on in their clubs because it just meant police coming. And it also meant more complications because I was a young white kid in there. And that was an issue sometimes, you know, when the cops would show, what's this guy doing here?
Okay.
Well, he's a musician, you know.
And so this was in Oakland
Oakland, North Richmond, all through the Bay Area, they had this whole little scene that, you know, I got to play with some great people on that scene, like Charles Brown, I got to play with Jimmy McCracklin.
Yeah.
You know, guys like that. The Bay Area seemed to be a place where a lot of blues guys, sidemen especially, ended up there. I mean, I was in heaven.
Times get tough. Rougher than rough. Better make me a lot of money. Just keep throwing the stuff.
But it was a really good education in how to basically handle yourself if you're going to do this.
Well, you know, I have a dream for you, and that is I want you to write a Dear Abby column. Like, you could be Abby, okay? And people would write to you who are musicians, and they would ask you questions about how to stay together in a band, you know, because...
Oh, separate hotel rooms.
It's,
it's
a marriage. I mean, 33 years with the Radiators. How long have you been married?
My wife and I have been together 40 years.
40 years? I mean, you stick. I mean, that's there's something about you that people want to be around. Okay.
Yeah, but I don't like giving up. So.
But still, I mean, you know something that a lot of people who work in music would like to know about how to handle yourself in that situation.
Well, a lot of it, you know, like with the Radiators, I mean, for 33 years, I mean, everybody has to stay focused on what is the prime objective.
Okay.
And you also have to keep in mind that this is all fun. I mean, it's a lot of fun. You get on stage, it's fun, it's great. Everybody yells, you know, there's not a lot of jobs where people applaud when you show up for work.
Exactly.
The other 22 hours, you run in a business. And it's no different than running AT&T or running a supermarket or anything else.
Well, so how do you deal with conflict resolution? This is the secret of life.
You need to keep lines of communication open. Just like in any relationship, the difference is this is like being married to four people instead of one person. It almost doesn't matter if you agree with them or not agree with them. The real issue is how do we resolve this so that everybody is on the same page and ready to move in the same direction. As long as you can keep the kind of musical dialogue open, you can last as long as you want to.
Well, you know, the Radiators, I mean, you all have all said individually as well as a group, I mean, that much of your fan base began with Tulane Kids, you know?
Uh-huh.
You know, because in the beginning, I used to call, like, some of your songs, like, Sigma Nu Love or yeah. Kappa Kappa Gamma Love, you know?
Like, oh, I didn't know the titles. I didn't know the titles for a lot of me either for a while.
Yeah, I mean, there was one, I remember it was like a love, not really a love song, but a kind of a lust song, I guess. Uh-huh. And it was called Nail Your Heart to Mine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. People love that song. I always thought that was a great title. It's, like,
it's violent and loving at the same time.
Is a unique lyricist.
Ed Volker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I think he's an underappreciated songwriter in the whole genre of rock. So that was one of the things that really fueled the Radiators too, is because at that time, there weren't a lot of people writing songs or doing original music because it was all disco and it was all kind of new wave punk stuff.
Sure.
And the fact that we could work with a songwriter, like I said, made it really appealing. I think to a certain extent, he kind of expected us to bring something to the table.
Right.
You know, like, well, you're the bass player, so what's the bass line?
Spill the beans, well, that means a spell.
Encore, for instance, I would pay to hear that song every night. Every night.
That was one of my favorite tunes. I thought we did a great song. That song actually predated the Radiators. It was in Ed's band that turned into the Radiators. To me, my take on this was like, it's like a George Porter Meters type of thing, man. Let's just, you know, crank
you do
it
hear
out.
It.
We had that kind of approach.
Everybody wanna get here. Everybody wanna get here. Suck the head, squeeze it, squeeze the tip.
The song that we cannot not talk about, Suck the Head.
Oh yeah. That also predated the Radiators.
Really?
It was it was the name of a dance they were having at Tips when it was still the 501 Club. And from what I understand, Ed was driving over to the gig, and he just started tapping a pencil or something on his tablet, and by the time he got to Tips, he had Sucked the Head, and he just kind of hummed it to everybody, and they just kind of did it. And then when the Radiators got together, we could not do it.
Right.
Because it was, you know.
Well, it's about crawfish.
Yeah, and it was a classic about crawfish. Actually, I think it was the first record we ever made. It was 45 of that.
Is that right?
Part one and two, yeah.
Part one and two.
Oh, yeah, you can't have a 45 without part two. Yeah.
Now, do you ever, at some point in those 33 years, think to yourself, you know, maybe we've evolved past Suck the Head?
It got tiring sometimes, people talking about the innuendos, you know? So we got tired of that actually more than we got tired of the song itself.
Your songs, they got deeper lyrically, they got deeper, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of their complex musical complexity. And then in 1995, you all do this great album, New Dark Ages, that has the song Long Hard Journey Home
right.
on it, which is just such a beautiful, beautiful song.
Oh, that was written for Fess.
Dreamed I saw Professor Longhair.
That's when Ed his lyrics seemed to start taking a different turn on that album. You know, I think he started getting more away from relationship type subjects to things that were more broader spectrum subjects.
Smiling down on the festival, a smile full of love. Said, keep on.
Thank you.
the Radiators with The Long Hard Journey Home. We're talking with bassist Reggie Scanlon. Coming up, the end of an era, the beginning of something big, and nothing short of a miracle at the 2012 New Orleans Jazz Fest. Stay with us. It's Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is a rebroadcast of one of our favorite interviews from 2012.
We just send this next and last song out to all of you because you've kept us wild and free all these years.
We're listening to Ed Volker, Dave Malone, Camille Baudouin, Frank Bua, and Reggie Scanlon at the 2011 New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, their last festival as the Radiators. Bassist Reggie Scanlon is with us. That the Radiators were disbanding, you were the only member who said that you were relieved.
Yeah.
What? Why?
Well, it had been going, you know, we'd done it for 33 years, and I was kind of like wanting to do something else. The Radiators gave me a huge opportunity to develop my bass playing the way I want. It gave me a laboratory to work in for 30 years. And it was great. I got to work with a terrific songwriter, great musicians. But at the end of 33 years, I just kept feeling like there's got to be something else to do. I mean, like this, you can feel it's ending because, I mean, we didn't rehearse anymore, really. We would, you know, and you could feel it throughout the whole band. And also, you know, you get to a certain age and you start thinking in realistic terms of how much time do I have left to play? How much stuff do I want to do besides this one band? Well, then you start doing the math and it's like, well, you know what? I got to start doing it now.
Let's hear it, y'all. 33 years. Ed, Frank, Reggie, Dave, Camille, Radiators. Saying goodbye.
He got all the money. He got all the money. He got all the money. And he won't give me none. He got all the whiskey.
The New Orleans Suspects. I mean, this is a band of giants, actually. You went from one one group to another. I mean, we're talking, Jake Eckert, who was the lead guitarist for the Dirty Dozen. C.R. Groover, who's a great pianist from Atlanta.
He's one of those guys we were talking about that can do Booker and Fest and stuff. I mean, the guy's ridiculous.
And then Jeff Watkins, who led the James Brown band?
He was James Brown's band leader for 12 years. And then
He's like in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah. And then we got Willie playing drums.
Willie Green.
You know, and he and I have been doing stuff together for, 15 years. And, he's always like, quit the Radiators. I'll quit the Neville Brothers. Let's do a band. I say, man, I can't do that. I got a household of support, So, but then when Ed made the announcement, I called Willie up and said, hey, guess what, man? The timing just all seemed right. Everybody just was at that point where they were ready to make a commitment to something new. Guys are like top draw players.
Yes.
And so it really made me have to be on my game 100% to play with these guys.
Do you have to drop some habits and pick up some others?
Well, it's a learning process because with Jake, originally Kevin Harris was playing sax with us from the Dozen. And so we were doing some of the brass band stuff, which, I've listened to that most of my life, but I've never played it.
Okay.
Which is a totally different thing. So when we started learning stuff like Blackbird Special, Jake was like, well, that's not really the way the bass parts go. You got the right notes, but there's a certain way to play them.
Okay.
And so that was a learning curve for me.
You all do a song called Oak Street Rag.
Yeah.
Okay, which to the discerning ear, sounds a lot like Play Something Sweet, the Alan Toussaint song, right?
Yeah.
The Brickyard Blues.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, Jake wrote that song, and he's an Alan Toussaint nut.
So play that beat, make it sweet, make my body move from my head down to my feet. Ain't no drag, just do that Oak Street rag.
I think he realized too that it was an homage to Alan. Fits the Maple Leaf and it fits that whole Oak Street scene, And the lyrics are pretty funny, I gotta say.
Oh, well, their band is a striking up late. Drummer's in the back trying to get his head straight. The tourists, they can't go wrong when the band kicks it off with the James Booker song. 100 degrees ain't no joke. Ever since Tuesday when the AC broke, the band is a dancing sweat. But the people keep on dancing when they're soaking wet. So play that beat, make it sweet, make my body move from my head down to my feet. Ain't no drag, just do that Old Street rag.
May I ask you, how are you feeling?
Me?
Yeah.
I feel great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because you've been under the weather lately.
Well, yeah, I did have kind of a health issue bump in the road this year, so.
So you were diagnosed with pancreatic cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on March 12th.
And you underwent Whipple surgery?
I had a Whipple on the 30th of March.
Whipple, sounds like a really fun name, but it's not a fun procedure.
No, it's John Whipple is the surgeon in the 30s who basically made the surgery a possibility. The basic Whipple is the removal of the gallbladder, the pancreas, and part of the duodenum. It can also include part of the stomach, small intestine, and the spleen. For me, it was just the gallbladder, duodenum, and the pancreas, and it was a 16-hour surgery because of the vascular problems that were involved with the tumor. So I was in the hospital for a month, got out 2 days before Jazz Festival, because I told my doctor, I said, look, I got to play Jazz Festival. I said, you don't understand how much problem we went through to get this gig at the Jazz Festival and get Quint to give us a slot. He goes, okay. He says, well, you can do the Jazz Festival. He said, but, you know, you're going to be worn out. And he was right. I went down there, did the festival, got in the car, came home, collapsed for 5 hours. But I did do the Jazz Festival.
I can't believe you did it, though. I cannot believe you pulled off the Jazz Festival.
Oh, no, I did that. And then I did 3 other gigs through the Jazz Festival. And then 3 weeks later, I was on the road.
Oh, my goodness.
So, but, you know, part of it was playing was really therapeutic for me. I mean, being on the road was, I mean, I did it, tried to do it as easy as I could. My band has been, I can't even say how accommodating. I mean, they have been wonderful. The biggest problem that I have now is because of the removal of the pancreas, I'm a type 1 diabetic. So it has taken some of the fun out of eating, you know, because, you know, every time you got to calculate this, that, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
By the time you do that, you're like, oh, man, you know, this isn't as much fun to eat this big piece of pie as it would have been, you know. So
I think that, you know, with anyone who has been ill, and I'm sure you've experienced this yourself, people don't necessarily know how to talk to you, how to approach you.
Yeah.
What, you know, I mean, what do you want people to say to you?
Well, you know, basically, I mean, I don't mind people talking to me about it, and I understand a certain discomfort in that, but I want to take whatever is the most comfortable path. If that means asking me a question, you know, I don't mind answering it because it's part of my reality now. And it was really amazing how many people responded, you know, when they found out. It was almost palpable, the energy or whatever it was.
The goodwill.
Yeah, that any, you know, if there's any good thing that came out of it is the fact that you go, wow, there's a lot of people in my corner, you know?
That's true. Okay, well, your druthers, what do you want to go out on for this interview? We can play anything you want.
Oh, gee, well, you know what? I mean, we also do Jesus on the Main Line because that's kind of like a leaving song, I guess.
Yeah, well, hopefully you will come back, though.
Oh,
right?
No, yeah, I'm coming back, but it's just like, you know, it's just a good kind of marching out song.
Okay, deal.
Jesus on the main line,
tell him what you want.
I said, call him up and tell him what you want.
You know, when the Radiators closed out the Jazz Festival, 2011 Jazz Festival, Quint Davis, who is the festival producer, says something like, in the history of the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, there have only been 3 acts that have, you know, traditionally closed the fest.
Right.
And he said it's Professor Longhair, the Neville Brothers, and the Radiators.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you are the only person who is related to all 3 of those acts.
Yeah, kind of. Well, I played the festival with Fess. You know, never played with the Neville Brothers, you know, on their thing.
But you're playing with me, Willie, and Willie Green.
But with Willie, yeah, there is a connection there. You know, I remember when I was like 20 years old going to see the Meters, and then, you know, years later, you find yourself like you're in that company. You know, you're playing with those guys, and it's you just kind of go, wow, how'd you get from there to here? You know, it's almost like a magic act.
Yeah. And at the same time, you're at the beginning of something.
Oh, yeah. Well, you always want to be at the beginning of stuff because that's really where the fun stuff is.
Well, thank you so much, Reggie
Scanlon. Oh, thank you.
You've just been great.
Well, this has been fun. So, I mean, I didn't have to do any work. All I had to do was just kind of blabber away for a few hours.
bassist Reggie Scanlon spoke to us in September 2012 at Elephant Quilt Studios in New Orleans. He's currently on tour with the New Orleans Suspects. For a full playlist of our show, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Lily Kieber, Sean Collins, Jason Wine, and Margaret Howes. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Music Inside Out is underwritten by the Historic New Orleans Collection, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, Adam Newman Studio, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.